Hi, my name is Greg Irwin, and I'm an A-Camera First AC on Feature Films, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Hey there, Ben Rock. How are you?
I'm doing swell, Ilya Friedman.
Welcome back to another fantastic episode of the Cinematography Podcast. Greg Irwin is on the show today. He is an amazing first AC. And let me tell you, if you go to his IMDb, it is just chock full with all these incredible huge movies, including tons of Marvel stuff. And he really kind of breaks down his philosophy and really sort of a guidebook to one of the most important and unsung roles on the set, which is the first AC. The first AC is very much sort of like a general in the department, controlling the flow of technology and information to the other members of camera teams. And Greg works on very big shows with huge teams. So it's really wonderful to chat with him for a little bit and get his perspective and take and tips on the whole thing.
And I assume that you get a little more technical than we usually do.
Yeah, that's true. I'd say maybe we get a little bit more technical, but really there's a lot of like workflow and attitude and sort of the apprenticeship mentality that we don't talk about enough, which I think is really great.
That's very cool. I've always thought first AC is one of the most stressful positions on the entire set.
Like, undoubtedly.
Everybody's watching what you're doing. Everyone is aware if you screw anything up. And, you know, an actor can like move an inch forward more than you're expecting them to and completely screw up your job.
Yes, all of those things are true. So, Ben, that is the guest this week. What's our close focus? What are we going to talk about this week?
And now, close focus.
There's kind of been, there was a great article in Variety that was kind of an autopsy of streamers. By the way, a quick trivia question. On literally on televisions, what is the number one streaming app?
Netflix?
YouTube.
Wow.
On televisions. Yeah. It gets like a distant first. The distant second is Netflix. And I encourage people to check out this article on Variety, just because what you'll learn is what is patently obvious, that during the quote unquote peak TV era, all of these streamers ludicrously overspent on television shows that not nearly enough people watched. And we're only now getting this data from places like Luminate that are making it clear that this was all a bid to increase subscribers, more importantly than profit. And then what happened was interest rates finally went up, so money wasn't basically free anymore. And all these companies, investors were like, hey, we'd like to get paid now. And they were like, oh, we can't keep making this quality of television, this very expensive level of television at this rate anymore. And so I feel like this is all going to get pinned on the unions going on strike last year. But I am assured that no matter what happened with those strikes, that a whole lot less TV was about to get made. And that's where we're at right now. And I think it's also kind of ludicrous to blame that on paying writers and actors. You know.
Yeah, well, AMPTP does not want to blame themselves. So there's that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think, though, interesting for our close focus, in addition to the apps, there was a survey conducted by cordcuttersnews.com, which basically breaks down what are the most popular hardware for streaming. So if YouTube is the most popular app, the way that they are watching the YouTube app more often than not is Roku, either a Roku box or a Roku TV. They have the majority.
I have a Roku TV. That doesn't surprise me at all. Half the TVs, probably most of the TVs, smart TVs, just have a Roku built into them now.
You know me, I travel a lot. I've been taking note, even though I don't usually end up watching TV in all the different Airbnbs and places that I'm staying, how many of them have Rokus. It seems like overwhelming. I'd say like 75% of the Airbnbs I'm in have either a Roku TV or a Roku box. Now, interestingly, behind that is a smart TV that's not a Roku. And then below that is Amazon Fire TV at about 30%. Below Amazon Fire TVs are PCs, which actually represent about 25%.
Does Google still make Chromecast?
They do. Chromecast is actually is sixth place. It's the lowest.
Really?
After PCs is Apple TV with about 20% of the market. And then sixth place is Chromecast with 15%. Actually, I take that back. There's a seventh place, which is even lower, which is video game consoles. Now, if you add up all these numbers, it actually adds up to be higher than 100%, but that is because so many people have multiple devices to watch. And so amongst all the multiple devices, even if it's someone's not primary device, Roku still wins. Most people who have multiple devices seem to also have a Roku. So yeah, it's very interesting. So with YouTube being such a popular thing to watch, and it doesn't surprise me, although it's not the same sort of watching that I think we've come to expect from streaming services, which are generally narrative stories or documentary stories. YouTube is usually about a different level of entertainment or utility. It's a different style. There's a lot of homebrew stuff. Google tried for a while.
What's a weird mix of that, though? Because there is genuinely professional stuff, and then there's stuff that started as homebrew that became as professional as anything on TV. You know, all you have to do is look at Mr. Beast. They're spending TV dollars on producing a show exclusively for YouTube.
Well, we got to talk about that because Mr. Beast just inked a deal with Amazon for the largest ever budget in a program at $100 million. It's a big, big deal.
That's not the highest budget because Amazon also made The Rings of Power for $1 billion.
Sorry. Game show. It's the highest budget. It's a game show that he's doing. And so he's got $100 million.
Man, The Rings of Power would have been a really cool game show. They missed the boat on that.
Oh, my precious. I never saw The Rings of Power.
I know. You get one ring to rule them all if you win. It's pretty amazing. It's like Ultimate Survivor.
I'm not betting against Mr. Beast. That guy, I think, has the ability to transition over from sort of the YouTube world to the freemium.
The fact that two olds like you and me know who Mr. Beast is speaks volumes because, you know, like almost anyone else who is a giant YouTube celebrity, it's very easy to be a huge celebrity on YouTube with a massive following, making six or maybe seven figures with purely YouTube income streams and YouTube sponsorships, blah, 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 and to be completely unknown outside of that little tiny group of people. For instance, my son watches a channel on YouTube called Dude Perfect. I don't know if you're familiar with Dude Perfect. They're huge, but like, you know, I honestly never would have heard of them had my son not been watching their videos.
Well, Dude Perfect's their company, their essentially marketing and promotional company is Mr. Beast. It's Knight Media. It's the same CEO. It's the same guy. So
interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stuff with him online. It's very interesting. A lot of people from reality television, a lot of people from sports programming have been moving into the YouTube space. And the dollars are a little bit different. The production is a little bit different. There's different things about it. But it's becoming a viable way, sort of a, you know, green light yourself, self-produced sort of thing with different sorts of revenue streams. But it's interesting to see what happens. I'm wondering if Google decides they're going to dust off sort of their old playbook, which they tried at the beginning, sort of earlier days of YouTube Red, YouTube Premium, the different sorts of like, you know, getting creators to make their own stuff. If Mr. Beast is successful or if they continue just to sit back and stay out of it. I'm really not sure what's going to happen.
Here's a question that I keep having about this. And this also just might be about me being from Venus? Being a Gen X person. We grew up and we have a tradition of movies. And granted, movies aren't paintings. Movies aren't novels. Movies aren't plays. They've been around for about 100 years, right? They've been a little bit more than 100 years. But there are classic movies like Citizen Kane, The Godfather, The Silence of the Lambs, whatever. These movies that like endure, stand the test of time that are watched by future generations. And I keep wondering about this because the thing about influencer culture and YouTube and TikTok is it's all very of the moment, which means that Mr. Beast, in my humble opinion, unless he changes a lot of what he does, is not going to speak to people in 20 years. in 20 years, he's going to look like what Dean Martin looked like to me when I was a kid in a bow tie and a ruffled tuxedo shirt. Like, the shtick won't hold up. And these terabytes upon terabytes of video that are going into YouTube aren't creating something that's like a timeless class. You're not making It's a Wonderful Life, and not by design. And no one's saying it should be that. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying is, by stealing all of our attention and focusing all of our eyeballs at that stuff, are we kind of robbing our culture of having? I'm not shitting on Mr. Beast or any YouTubers.
No,
watch YouTube tons of YouTube myself. You know, I talk all the time about freaking Corridor Video, Corridor Digital. I love those guys, but those guys aren't making classic movies that we're going to be watching in 20 years. They're making cool videos about, hey, what if you did this or what if you did that, or let's analyze VFX or animation. And it's like, that stuff is not, it's kind of a meta commentary. So much of what TikTok and YouTube are about is commentary about something else. So
there's a long tail. There's a long tail, but I agree that we're not making stuff for 50 years from now. And you know, by evidence, and I don't know if you guys can hear it, but my teenagers are downstairs watching Terminator 2 for the first time. Terminator 2 holds up really effing well.
It's an amazing film.
And it's true. I think most of the stuff that's being made for YouTube is ephemeral and timely and topical. And it's not about making, you know, art for the ages. It's not about coming back to it in 20 yeah. years or something. So, but that doesn't mean it's bad.
And I feel like
it's
that's just, what we talk different. About on this show. Yeah. When we talk about something like Oppenheimer, you know, Poor Things or whatever, like all of those Oscar-y movies that we just kind of got through. I could imagine somebody in 50 years watching those movies and appreciating them, if only movies are still watched and appreciated in 50 years. And that's the real question.
Yeah, it is. And I don't think we're going to be able to get the answer to that in this episode of the podcast. So
no, we're going to right now.
I think we should get to the interview with Greg Irwin.
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by Greg Irwin, who is an A-camera first AC on theatrical motion picture films, and he's been doing it a little while, I think about 44 years. So really, we're very fortunate to have this authority in the world of the camera department. Greg, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You've done a lot of work. And I know, you know, you and I met at Cinegear Atlanta this year, and you did a great presentation at Cinegear all about the realities of modern day working in the camera department. And I want to get into that here in just a minute, but give me a little bit about your backstory. Tell our listeners how you got into this and basically, you know, what it was like 44 years ago.
Oh my God. It was like before cinema existed. No, I got into it at a very young age. I became a first AC at the age of 18. I was still going to college. My high school had a four-year film program. That's where I fell in love with it. And then, of course, college, I went to film school all 4 years and ended up getting three business degrees at the same time. So I've applied all of that to how I operate and function a camera department on the big feature films. But I started on a TV show called MASH. I did TV for about 4 or 5 years. Murder, She Wrote, The A-Team, Airwolf. But I really wanted to be doing the big movies, so I concentrated on that. And shortly after I got my TV start, I swapped over to features, and I've been there ever since. That was probably around 1985.
All right. So from there on. So back then it was all film. And you might have been lucky to have a video tap back then. I mean, video tap was a luxury item, like a big luxury item. So you were pulling focus and you know, perfecting your craft day in and day out without any feedback until the next day, if you were lucky to be able to see what it was that you shot.
And absolutely.
So talk a little bit just about this aspect, which has completely changed the instant gratification you get now, where you know whether or not you're in focus, you know if everything's going to turn out. What was the reality of work in the you know, 80s and 90s? Yeah.
Right. I think the reality back then, it was the norm. You know, you had to be by the camera. You were basically judging air, very intangible craft. And like you said, you had to wait a day or two before you knew if you did a good job or not. And sometimes, you know, especially when you're young and inexperienced, you're sweating all that time until you know. And of course, you know, we all make mistakes. That's just part of it. It's a very difficult job, and you have to have a personality and a skill that can handle that. Once we went digital, that was very late in my career, and I always like to describe it as a 12-year-old was teaching me how to do digital. But it was basically starting over. It was a whole new language, file compression, resolution, you know, terms that we never used in the film world. And then I think the sharpness of, what was it, maybe 2K back then, was very frightening as a focus puller because it was just an unknown world. Until I started, for me, getting into the monitor focus pulling, which is a whole nother skill set. Some first ACs adapt well, some have a tough time at it, but that's a personal preference. You know, you could try to do it old school, you know, like film, trying to eyeball it all the time. Sometimes people have a tough time doing that. But what I like on the monitor is, like you said, the instant gratification. I know what I got, I know when I got it, and we can move on, and there's no worrying about it after that. The other aspect that I find wonderful about monitor focus pulling is I'm watching the movie in real time. It's not like standing next to the camera and you're trying to understand where the frame lines might be. Is this in frame or is it out of frame? You can see it. And with that, you have storytelling opportunities with focus. You could reach for things that you wouldn't have had the courage to do or even the knowledge to do in the film days by seeing it on the monitor.
Yeah, it's definitely feels like it's a different discipline. And the way I see so many, certainly young people starting out into the camera crafts, when they start pulling focuses, their face is about 2 inches from the monitor. They're in there very close, and they have a wireless remote follow focus system happening, so they can be constantly adjusting the focus to make sure that you know, whatever is supposed to be in focus is in focus. But this is a world away from a time when, I mean, when I started coming up in the early 90s, some cheap music videos I was on didn't want to even get a manual follow focus, so all of my pulling was off the barrel. So it's a pretty big departure. And I guess my question really for you is that, you know, people today who don't have that discipline, who don't have that skills, if their wireless system goes down, if they don't have a monitor of some sort of problem, is everyone just hosed? If you don't have the skills to rely on, how do you make the shot?
That's a very good point. I think they would be very nervous, that's for sure. You know, I think I might be a little nervous going back to film these days because we're all so entrenched in the digital world. Mm. And yes, I have shot film, you know, recently, but it's just a different mindset and you have to reprogram yourself and the way you work. For me, I live on a Preston, a remote focus, whether it's film or digital. And that's just my personal preference because I could be wherever I want to be at any time pulling focus. Being an A camera first, you know, being the head of the department and the main person who has to convey all of the information to my team, I like to sit back at the DIT in the digital world because I know that's where the director of photography is. That's where all the information hub is. And I could be listening. I could be pulling focus. I don't need to be on set to do this. And I could be relaying all the information and delegating from there. And for me, that works. It doesn't work for everybody. Some people have to have a line in sight, you know, and be on set, be near the camera. That's no problem. You could do whatever it takes. You know, in the end, you just want to get it in focus and not have too many takes to get that job done. So again, you ask 10 different focus pullers how they like to do it. You'll get 10 different very good answers.
I think that's a wonderful jumping off spot. And we should get into some of the stuff that you went through when we met over in Atlanta at Cinegear. Mm-hmm. You had a fantastic presentation. You're going to have to remind me, though, about the title of that presentation because it's fallen out of my brain right now. What was that presentation called?
I like to call it Character and Credibility because that's what you have to have in this kind of department to do a job that's expected of you. And I'm not a total techie first AC. I know the gear. I know cinematography inside and out. But my key second assistant, who's been with me for years, he's the techie guy, and I leave all that stuff up to him. I take more of a business approach to the camera department because I am the head of the department. I am dealing with the studio, with our producers, with the filmmakers, and by that I mean the director and cinematographer. And of course, I'm pulling focus and making sure our team is working efficiently day in and day out. You know, it's ultimately my responsibility, and I take that very seriously. But I don't really, honestly, touch the gear that much anymore at this stage of my career. And I don't think that's a bad thing. I don't think that's for everybody. But for my team, it's better. I don't micromanage. I hire the best people I can get for the job. And because of that, I've had a solid, solid team of rock stars for many years. And I'm very proud of them and very proud of the fact that we're all still together picture after picture. And because of that, we're a very efficient and very humble team. You know, that's another thing to keep the humility. We're not the most important aspect of the set. We're just part of a whole.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, your delineation between the different crew members in your department. I used to work with someone who would always refer to the second AC as the director of photography equipment. And it was like, you know, if it's an item, it needs to be asseted, it needs to be, you know, organized, that this was going to be their domain. And
right.
I think that the way that you've got it structured sounds like it works really well for you and your team, and that you've established the discipline in order for everyone to function that way. How long did it take you to come up with this current style? Or did you try on a few different hats, a few different ways before you settled on this?
Well, you know, it's a learning experience. It's a journey. All, you know, over all the years I've been doing it, and for anybody out there, it's you're always evolving your working style. And it changes with the times, to be honest. It changes. Technology will drive the way you work. Just being on set. Being on set today is vastly different than it was being on set years ago. And that's just the way time marches on. So you have to be able to evolve and adapt to whatever situations you're in. For me, it's been several years. I mean, a lot of years that I took this approach. I've always had a sense of business for this industry. I teach at the university level, or I don't teach, I lecture to some major film schools, to their classes. I've been doing that for 35 years. And I don't teach cinematography. They have their professors, their instructors to do that. I teach the business of the camera department. That's what's important to me. Now, the focus pulling and the day-to-day routine of what we do, setting up shots, executing the shots, being efficient and being quick, that's muscle memory. My entire team has that down pat. We don't have to think about it anymore. But what's important to me personally for my job is to have good character to establish that credibility with the studio, with our producers and the filmmakers, because I think problems are inevitable at some level. You are going to have mistakes. There are going to be challenges that are out of your control, but if you have that credibility, you will power through them much easier than if they don't see you in that way. And I've witnessed the other end, you know, with other people who just struggle and get crucified out there. And it's not right. It's just how human nature is. So what I teach to my team is that character and credibility. We don't panic. We're not rude. We're very eager to help. It doesn't matter what department we're helping. We are in a leadership role. The camera department is the centerpiece of the process. So I think the entire camera department is in a leadership role. I can't tell you how many times we've been on sets where things are happening that we don't agree with. The grips, the set lighting, hair and makeup, or wardrobe. Who do they come to? They quite often come to me wondering how we should handle a particular situation. This doesn't happen often, but it has happened. So that's why I say the camera department is a leadership department for the entire set. That's why you have to have character and credibility, and I push and push and push that. For me, communication is everything. I'm not one of those first ACs that withholds information and keeps everybody else in the dark. That doesn't do me any good. I want my team to know everything at all times, and I want them to be better than me. If I can develop a young camera person into a rock-solid, good human being, as well as a great camera technician or whatever, you know, then I've done my job right. Because I'm the biggest cheerleader of everybody there. I want them to be better than me. And that's not too hard.
Well, Go ahead. I didn't mean to, I wasn't going to interrupt you, but I was like, let's get into some of these bullet points. I'm fascinated by, you know, the leadership roles and the character and the credibility, mm-hmm. but you teach about the business of this department. Well, give us like a couple of the overview of the business of camera and how this, right. this kind of plays together.
Well, one of the things is it's the day-to-day things and how we approach a production to establish all that. But I do want to talk about one thing first. When I was in business school, in college, I learned a business philosophy, something called the one-minute manager. It's a series of books. You can get them on Amazon. It was a business philosophy that basically said, if you're in a leadership role and you have employees, you should be able to manage them in 1 minute or less if you did your job correctly the first time. And what that means is you hired correctly. You didn't hire your friends or your buddies. You hired the right person for the job. And because I practice the one-minute manager, I've hired the perfect team, in my opinion, and I don't have to micromanage them. My job is to listen to what they need and to get them what they need within the parameters of our budget and schedule. And it's also my job to keep the entire team on task, on goal, towards the end result. That's what's important. So business points. Let's start with the prep. You know, I get called to do a movie. I won't even talk about rates, money, deals, probably until the fourth phone call. I don't want to go there. I want to get to know the producer I'm dealing with. I want to get to know the movie. I want to get to know what our challenges are going to be up front, what are opportunities to take advantage of in a business sense, and what we're not going to be able to do because of budget or schedule limitations. So I'll establish a relationship with the producer, production manager right up front. And we'll, you know, we'll talk about the movie. We'll talk about our kids. We'll talk about real life. We'll get to know each other. And by that, I get to learn who I'm going to be negotiating with. I love negotiating. To me, it's a game. It's a game I like to win. It's something that none of us should shy away from or be intimidated about. It's a skill, yeah, but it's a skill that one can learn. And I think it's a very important skill because we negotiate everything, not just our deals. You're negotiating in this business, your prep schedules, your equipment, your amount of labor you're going to have when. In real life, we negotiate every day on things, you know? So it's a very important skill to get comfortable with, in my opinion. So I'll establish that relationship with the producer and then say by the fourth call or so, now we're going to start talking the business aspects. By then, we have a relationship. By then, I know how to negotiate my deal and pave the way for the rest of the team. I don't negotiate anymore for my team because I think they like doing that themselves because maybe they could do a better job than I could do. And I don't want to have that responsibility if I don't do a good job for them. But I'll pave the way for them and make sure the producer understands what to expect from them, whether they're overscale or whatever, you know, their equipment deals, you know, I'll just pave the way. I'll also negotiate the prep schedule, how many weeks of prep, the staggered start of the labor, you know, who starts when. I think it's important to note that I do something called I prep the prep. And what that means is by the time I walk into the rental house on day one of camera prep, prep is done. All we have to do at that point is execute what we've planned. My goal every time is the camera package that I finally submit before the first day of prep, that's going to be the package I walk out the door 5, 6, 8 weeks later, depending on how long our preps are. Our preps are usually 6 to 8 weeks, I would say. And that's because for weeks prior to that, I build the camera package on paper based on meetings, based on discussions with the filmmakers, mainly the DP. We go through many variations, many drafts. I timestamp and number every draft, so I have a record of everything in my computer. But by the time we get to draft number 10, at that point, I can walk into that rental house and I know that that's going to be the package I walk out several weeks later with. And that's the credibility part. No add-ons, no big price changes to the producers, no shocks to the budget. I know what the budget is. I stick to that. I can negotiate that very well if we need to expand it. And I'll back that up with facts, you know, from the filmmakers. And we go from there. So I like prepping the prep so the actual prep is simple. I think that is a very important aspect to the way we work.
I like that a lot. And having worked on both sides of that rental counter, worked as the customer and also as the company doing the renting, I'll tell you that when you work in the rental house, you know real quick who's coming into prep, how much experience they have, and what sort of day that you might be in for. And the prep techs, who usually sort of get sometimes the lower person on the totem pole, and then usually the account managers who have to deal with the production and deal with the ACs to make those changes and adjustments. That sometimes I'm sure that you've experienced at some point before you got to the system, that can balloon or shrink or change so radically that the rental house might not be able to accommodate. I remember one prep in particular, they had a tripod for every camera. These are O'Connor 2575s. But then at the last minute, they decided that they wanted 9 additional 2575s. And as the rental house, it was like, I will have to do the best that we can, but I don't know if we can accommodate 9 extra right now for your 2 cameras. So when you're in these situations where sometimes it's you maybe don't have any control, and then someone throws you the curveball and says we got to change something. Do you have a certain tactic that you like to do, or do you try to horse trade, or how do you make that prep smooth? Yeah.
Well, you know, of course, everything I said is subject to those above us not changing the concept or changing major story things in the script that we have to respond to. So assuming that most of the time it's true that we stay with the program, with what we know, it's very possible that we don't have to make big changes. Now, little changes, yeah, but nothing that's going to blow the budget out of whack. If they make massive script changes, like I did a lot of the Fast and Furious movies, that script was changing daily and we had to respond, you know, react to it daily. And of course, that's going to cost the producers. But in that case, the producers knew it. So there wasn't any battle at all. But in the case of a smaller picture, let's say, if you come in ill-prepared and as the prep goes, and let's say the prep is only 5 days and you're making it up as we go, you know, as you go, the budget's going to get blown out of whack, and then you have to explain this to the producer who is not willing to make out a purchase order so you could ship out. And that's what I don't want. I want to have a clear communication with the rental house, with the marketing exec of the rental house, our prep tech, and our producers, because no surprises. That just ruins my credibility. And that's not good. And that's what I won't stand for. So everybody, the producers have the list. Of course, the DP has the list. If we need to talk about it further, we will. If we have to massage the list, we will. But overall, day one of prep is going to be the package we ship out with. Maybe some little knick-knacky changes, but the big ticket items will not change. And that's very important to me.
There is a lot of attention that's paid to the camera department on set. You know, there's very few people who are working at the moment that the actors are acting. The director is absorbing it all, you know, but the camera department is right there. They're in the center of all of it. So it's like, if you are panicked, you know, you're setting the tone for everyone else around you. They're like, wow, if camera department's panicked, maybe I should be panicking too. It's not
That's exactly right. That's right. You are the bellwether. Camera department, again, it's the centerpiece of the process, and all eyes are on that centerpiece. When I was 20 years old, I worked for the wonderful Jonathan Alcott, BSC.
Oh, sure.
He did a lot of the Stanley Kubrick movies. He was doing a commercial in Los Angeles, and I was the first AC, the second AC, and the loader. I'm 20 years old, so I'm not the most experienced at that time. But I knew who Jonathan was. I was thrilled to death to be working with him. It was such an honor. I had long hair. I wore a t-shirt, shorts, Vans. You know, I was 20 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a Friday on that job. And this is going back to the leadership role and setting the example that we've been speaking of. It was a Friday, and Jonathan was sitting in his chair, and he was watching me critically as I was building the camera, loading it, you know, scrambling everywhere, trying to keep up with the pace of things. And I was aware he was staring at me, and he was making me pretty nervous. Finally, he called out and said, "Gregory, come over here, please." So I jumped up, ran over to him. "Yes, sir. What department are you in?" "Me? Camera?" "That's right. You're in the camera department. May I suggest a haircut and a collared shirt? You're supposed to be the ones to represent the centerpiece of the process. You're also supposed to be among the educated ones on set. If you insist on looking like that, join the grips. Now off with you, boy." Now, nothing against the grips. They work very hard and they have to dress for the part. But I took that very seriously, and in 30 seconds, Jonathan changed my life.
Wow.
That Monday morning, I came to work with a haircut and a collared shirt, and for over 40 years, that has not changed. I always will have a collared shirt and look the leadership role. You know, a lot of the guys tease me that I'm the executive first assistant. I could live with that. That's okay with me, because in the end, we get the job done, and we get it done very well. And we leave the movie in a better place than we came in on the movie. And that also is very important to me. And that's because we conduct the business very well of the camera department.
All right. So being a camera assistant, it can be a very physically demanding job. It can be extremely tiring. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of heavy gear to move. In some ways, the work that you're doing is very similar to that of a grip. You're transporting cases full of stuff. Now,
100%.
I gotta imagine, though, that being in a collared shirt, button-up shirt, and moving and lifting and all that stuff. And now, granted, I know the way that you work now, you may not have to do all that, but not everyone out there is so fortunate. Sometimes budgets are much smaller. You just like you were talking about with Mr. Alcott, you know, it's like, it's entirely possible that you're filling multiple roles. How do you do the best to present yourself and also not sweat through your shirt and not appear, you know, like, you know, the grips may be dressed for comfort, but there's a very good reason for that comfort too. They have to do a lot of labor. So how do you strike this balance in the camera department?
God bless them for doing the job they do, because we couldn't do ours without them. You know, years ago when I was getting, you know, I still get dirty, but when I was lifting all the stuff, you know, I'm 62 now. And I've had rotator cuff surgery, double hernia surgery. My body is broken down from this job. But I would obviously carry everything. You just do it. You know, you don't worry about the wardrobe. If I wore out to wear a shirt, you get another one, you know, or you sew it up and keep going. You don't worry about it. But back in those days, you know, when I got started, there was an unwritten code of conduct for the camera department. And that was the collared shirt and haircut thing. The grooming was an unwritten, understood part of the job. Now, of course, you know, we're in a different times and that would never be able to be enforced. And that's okay. But it doesn't take away from the messaging of what our role is on set. So, yeah, if you don't want to wear a collared shirt, don't. Wear a t-shirt. Be yourself. But concentrate on the rest of what I'm talking about, because that really is the important part. And conducting the camera department business. I mean, let's face it, we work in the film industry. We work in show business. Those are two key words to where I'm coming from. We have to represent those interests as well. We're working for a company that's spending an ungodly amount of money on an untested product. So we don't have to add more mystery to the success or failure of this product, being the movie. Of course, we don't know what the box office is going to be. You might be making the greatest movie you think you're making, and it bombs. Conversely, I've worked on plenty of terrible pictures, I thought, and they're huge box office hits. You never know. But that doesn't change the fact that we have a job to do and to be organized enough to have the character and credibility to represent our department on set in front of the studio producers, filmmakers, and the rest of the crew. I'm passionate about that, and I always will be. And if I get any message out today, that is my message. Learning the gear is academic. We have to know the gear. If you're going to be a focus puller, you have to know how to pull focus. But that next step, that next intangible, is what makes the difference between the great ones and the good ones. Because we all could do the same job to a certain level, but then the great ones will separate and go another level up or more. And to me, that's what we should be concentrating on. And that's with our organization, our lack of sense of entitlement. I've seen so many camera departments who have this sense of entitlement that you should worship them or treat them differently than the grips or the PAs or whatever. No way, man. We're part of an overall team. We have a very important job to do, but it's no more important than what everybody else does. Everybody should have that respect, not just the camera department. We're just more visible than many of the other departments. So, you know, that's another thing business-wise I won't put up with is any sort of sense of entitlement within our ranks. I don't like firing people because if I have to let somebody go, going back to the one-minute manager philosophy, then I did my job wrong. I failed. This is on me, not the individual being let go. I did not hire correctly or smartly. I made a mistake. So I've only had to do that maybe 3 times in my entire career. And it's the worst because I take it very personally. But there have been several times in my career where we just will not invite you back without any explanation because you either live up to our standard or you're not a part of our team, period. That's why we do the big movies.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And so we've talked about sort of like, you know, worst case scenario then of you know, if everything went wrong and you do have to get rid of someone, you're taking that onus, that responsibility onto yourself that you made a mistake, that there was an error in judgment or whatever happened. I think that's I think that's the way it should be. I look at it very similarly for me at my job, and I was a first AC for a long time too. And thankfully, I didn't have to fire very many people. It's a miserable experience to do that.
It's terrible.
But
terrible.
I will tell you the reason that I often chose my second, or the reason I often chose the other people that I was working with, was who did I like spending 15 hours a day with? Who did I like, you know, actually having the presence of their company? Who was a calming force? Who was like, you know, no matter what the situation was, they were going to be able to roll with the punches in a very real way. And I was working on extremely independent, much lower budget projects than you are for the vast majority of the work I was doing. Talk a little bit about how you get that shot, how someone convinces you to take a shot on them. Because ultimately, if you want to choose your friends, you want to choose the people you like, you don't mind being in a van with for 3 hours as you drive over a hill. How does someone break into that circle? Because ultimately, skills only get you so far. The skills, like there's a lot of people who can do that job, but how do you get to that next step? Or how do you convince someone that you're worthy of being included in that circle?
Vetting. They're vetted. You know, I've only had 4 key seconds in my career, and those were very top-notch professionals whom I enjoyed spending my days with. Jamie, my current one, I've known him since he was probably 9 years old. His dad was my dolly grip.
Oh, wow.
And so when Jamie became a young adult, got into this business, got into the camera department, you know, we had many years where we were running in different circles and different cities, all that. But here in Atlanta, where I live now, having moved from Los Angeles, Jamie came on board immediately as my key second, being local here in Atlanta as well. He's a fixture in Atlanta. And, you know, his reputation, we spoke a lot, we talked a lot before anything happened. Knowing him and his father, I had a lot of respect for that. And, you know, I think I said to him, you know, let's give it a try. Let's see how we fit together. And it's never stopped. It's been a wonderful fit. And he's a great guy. You know, we all have our strengths and weaknesses. And I try to balance my weaknesses out with strength. And with Jamie, He is so intelligent on the technology. He's so current on what's coming out, new gear, what could be useful for us, what fits our style of working. You know, he's way more up to date than I'll ever be. And I think that's because he's on Instagram and I'm not. But, you know, that works for us. So if there's a time, you know, Jamie's going to want to move up to First AC and there's going to be a job opening. I know there'll be a lot of interest because there has in the past when this has happened. But I will vet very carefully to get the same type of character. Because if I hire somebody that can't live up to our standards, again, who does that reflect on? That reflects on me. And that's tough to do when you have a reputation to uphold. I think I have a good reputation. You know, we get hired by producers. We get hired by directors, must hires. Recently, Jamie and I were brought to LA as distant hires to do the sequel to Joker. They could have easily hired in Los Angeles. There are so many qualified and wonderful camera people out there. But because of the producers and Warner Brothers, it was a studio thing. We were brought out as distant hires in Los Angeles from Atlanta. That is pretty huge in my book. That's, you know, we felt very humbled by it. Not a sense of entitlement, but very humbled. And we're thrilled to do it.
Greg, I'm really glad you brought up Jamie, because, and not necessarily for the reason you might think, because, you know, the question I asked was, you know, how does someone get the shot? And you essentially brought up nepotism. And I don't think nepotism is a bad word. Nepotism in our industry gets a bad rap. People make a big deal about this, but ultimately, the best people that I have worked with in the camera department are second and third generation people who have literally like been steeped in it from birth. They have like, you know, been so through osmosis, they have learned all the terminology and so much stuff. And I will tell you that nepotism, in my opinion, it only gets you so far. It gets your foot in the door. And there is no way that you were going to put up with, you know, the wrong person. Nepotism doesn't give you any job security. Nepotism just, all it does is gives you like a fighting shot to be put a little bit further forward than some other people. And the fact that, frankly, when you are second or third generation, all of the people that I can think of that I worked with who came up in the camera in particular, it felt like they were some of the most calm and relaxed people, because I think they were often visiting their parents back in the days and on sets and learning just from the conversations at the dinner table or in the parking lot or wherever it might have been, because they came out and visited. So I think it's great that you are working with Jamie. I think it's great that you have a second gen person who's coming in. For the people out there who don't have that pedigree, they don't necessarily have, you know, something being born into it, I always felt that like you are your own best resume, how you present yourself just in general, how you are on set. And you never know when you're going to be connected with someone who's connected with someone, especially on the multi-camera days. If you're lucky enough to get in on like a G camera, you're your own walking resume. I mean, I don't know what you feel, but how do you feel for that person who, you know, they don't have any sort of special, you know, relationship advantage, not any like just, you know, hey, I went to union orientation and I learned this X camera. How does someone separate themselves and get themselves, you know, how do you break out of the pack if you want to get attention, you want to get a new job, you want to move up?
That's interesting. That's a good question because, well, first of all, I never thought of Jamie as nepotism. I thought I had hired the right person.
Yeah, yeah.
Regardless of the ties. It's not wrong, but that wasn't the motivation.
Sure, of course.
To answer your question, my former second assistant as well, one the third of four, is a wonderful first AC, A-camera first AC now in Los Angeles, named Tulio Duenas. He came to me as a 19-year-old, as a camera PA, no family ties in this business, just sheer desire. He worked as my PA, came on as my loader eventually, then he moved up to second assistant. Eventually, he moved up to key second assistant with me when Jerry was doing something else, Jerry Batten. And Tulio, I think, was with me 9 years. And then Julia wanted to move up to first AC and it was time for him to do it. But he exhibited all the fortitude and intelligence and sheer desire to achieve what he's achieved. And he's achieved a lot. He's achieved greatness. And I'm so proud of him. And here's a case in point to where I want my team to be the best they could be. If they're better than me, power to them. That would make me the happiest person in the world. I'm not that guy that's going to keep withhold information to make myself look better, because that never works. You never do look better. You just decapitate the team from doing the job that they're hired to do. So that's a big part of my business philosophy, is to support, promote, encourage, and just get them to a level of greatness if I'm able to. And, you know, I've had my failures in the past. Not everybody has the fortitude to achieve this. But Tulio is a great example of starting off coming in as a teenager, and now he's A-list all the way, and I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, I think that Tulio is a great example, and sometimes you gotta work your way up. Take the opportunities that you're given, and do well, because I definitely felt like people who were my interns absolutely became my second ACs, and you know, first ACs on other cameras.
Yes.
Because they showed the hustle and the drive and the determination to actually really master the craft. I think
100%.
That is really the, I think, the thing that separates the people who are tourists in the industry from the people who actually are,
yes,
are making it their career.
Amen. I agree with that 100%. And I think it's also better to promote from within, to move somebody up and give them that well-deserved opportunity, than to just say, okay, you're moving up, all right, you're moving out. You know, I'm going to replace you and good luck to you. No, it doesn't work like that. That's very shallow. So, you know, I always want to move up everybody I can. Jamie's going to move up to focus puller. I'll put him on the third camera till he gets his skills honed. Then eventually my B camera guy is probably going to move on to operating or something. I don't know. It's hard to predict, but if that happens, then Jamie will probably move to the B camera. Eventually I'm going to retire. Guess who's going to take over the team if I have my way? Jamie. That's the way it should work. We support each other. We encourage each other. That's how people become great and stay great, without having ego or overconfidence. That drives me crazy when I see that. I don't have time for that.
Do you find, you know, over the years, you've had, you know, 44 years in this business, have you had many people come in who were camera assistants who then eventually moved on to DPs, and then you worked with them as then an AC for them when they used to be an AC for you? I'm just curious.
Absolutely. One of my ACs ended up being the president of the ASC. So, you know,
nice.
And a lot of former second ACs, not necessarily A camera, but seconds on my team, are now incredible operators. And I think that's wonderful. We all choose where we want to be in the ladder of things. And I thought at one point, years and years ago, I wanted to be a camera operator. I never wanted to be a DP. I don't think I have the skill or the artistry. I know that, so forget it. But I thought I wanted to be an operator. And I did move up for a brief moment. And I was so bored with it because I missed the risk taking of being an A camera first. I missed the riskiness of focus pulling. And because I embraced that, I think, is why I've been a focus puller and a successful one, I think, for so long. They told me I'm the number two focus puller in Hollywood, but then I found out there were 600 others tied for first. So I don't know what to do.
I always found the aspect of working as a first AC super satisfying to me as someone who likes puzzles. I like all kinds of puzzles, like whether it be a mechanical puzzle or taking apart an engine or, you know, a jigsaw puzzle, or you name it. What else is it about being a first AC that is attractive to you, other than the risk and danger? Because there is a little bit of that, you know, as a first AC, there's a lot of pressure on you. And second AC, certainly in the loading days too, there's a lot of pressure to make sure that there is no light that ever got into a magazine or into your bag or your changing room or any of that stuff. There's a lot of risk and danger there. And also I would say that the risk and danger is sometimes not proportional to the payments that you're receiving. The payments and the danger do not always line up exactly. So sometimes way more danger. But what is it about the craft of being an AC that is satisfying to you? You know, if you were to vocalize it, if you were going to put it into words, where does the satisfaction come from?
Trying to control the uncontrollable. period. All of my life, I've been into high-risk sports. I've raced ocean racing, big boat, sailboats all over the world. Been in situations that were probably most people would never want to be in, you know, being 1,000 miles offshore and you're your only support. Risky. You know, I've done high-altitude mountaineering. Risky. You know, so this job fits my personality. Financially, I do very well. So that's not a concern to me. But every job is challenging for different reasons. You know, it's not just the focus pulling. It might be the logistics of shooting in multiple countries with multiple cultures, multiple languages, people that you don't know who these people are, but they're on your team. I was the international guy for the studios very young in age coming up because I spoke different languages and I understood protocols and all that. And I got good at it too. I got good at navigating the camera department across borders. So I've shot all over the world and I have camera friends in so many countries that if we go to Eastern Europe, I know who to call. If we go to England, I know who to call. If we go to Japan, Thailand, I know who to call. And I think that gives me an element of satisfaction aside from financial gains or losses. Being able to solve the puzzle, as you phrased it, is very challenging on an intellectual level for me. You know, there's not too many things I haven't done in this business, but there's always something that comes up that I've never done before. And the conversation always starts the same. Well, how in the world are we going to do this one? You know, and you figure it out. You figure it out, you know, with help, with your team, with the filmmakers, but you work it out and you execute it. And that is incredibly satisfactory.
Yeah, I agree. You know, Greg, I think that's a great place for us to leave it. Are you on any form of social media? If people want to track you down, is there a way for people can do it on any of the on any of the socials out there?
I'm an old guy. I'm not on social media. I refuse to be. My wife is, but I'm not. My grandchildren are. I kind of stay away from it.
I understand completely. Well, if you want to find Greg, look at the local 600 guide directory and you can find Greg's information in there. Greg, thank you so much for being on the show. It was a real delight to chat with you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
All right, so that was Greg Irwin. Greg, thanks so much for chatting with me about your craft and your techniques. It was wonderful. I really hope that you can come on the show and talk about some more stuff in the future. There was just so much good information in there.
And now, Short Ends.
So, Ben, it is our famed Short End time of the show. It's when we talk about our pet obsessions. It could be anything. What are you about this week? What do you got going on?
Well, I recently kind of went down a rabbit hole, as did the whole culture with Dune. And I remembered that in 2013, there was a documentary about a failed attempt to turn Dune into a movie in the 1970s. Are you familiar with this documentary?
No, I am not.
Okay. So I remember when it came out and it was something that I had wanted to go see and I never saw it. It's called Jodorowsky's Dune. Now, are you familiar with Alejandro Jodorowsky?
I am, and I have actually heard someone tell me about this, but it was in passing, and it was during South by Southwest, and I did not pay them much mind. But no, yeah, okay. How was it?
Well, for people who aren't familiar with Jodorowsky, he is, I would say...
It's not Jodorowsky?
No, it's Jodorowsky. It's okay. It's a yeah sound. Okay. I would say the preeminent filmmaking surrealist, kind of the precursor to David Lynch. Probably his three best-known movies are El Topo, The Holy Mountain, and Santa Sangre. But he's made a bunch. And he's still alive. He's super old. And in 1974, he tried to adapt Dune. And the weird murderer's row of interesting people he had lined up to be in Dune, he went around the world collecting these people to be in it. So just as a couple examples, to play the emperor, he got Salvador Dali. To play Baron Harkonnen, he got Orson Welles. Mm. He got Pink Floyd to agree to score the film.
Wow.
He found, as a designer, a relatively unknown guy named H.R. Giger. to design some of the ships. I think he was doing he was focusing on the Harkonnen ships. He got relatively newcomer in the business named Dan O'Bannon to help out with some of the visual effects as well. He had just done a movie for John Carpenter called Dark Star. And on and freaking on and freaking on. So many awesome people. And the documentary, again, it came out in 2013. I had wanted to see it and I just never got a chance to. And I noticed it was on Max, so I checked it out. And it's riveting. But also, you look at this and you go, if Jodorowsky never got to make the movie, but there's tons of concept art, tons of storyboards. He boarded the whole thing. His movie would have been a wild, psychedelic, freakish, very early 70s. I think it might have been a little bit like Zardoz. If I'm perfectly honest, but way more creative than that. And that movie's pretty freaking creative, but like way more creative. If you've ever seen The Holy Mountain, you don't even need to, I mean, like definitely see The Holy Mountain, but you could just watch the trailer for The Holy Mountain and you'll be like, what in the Christ? So he would have done Dune like that. It was going to be a huge big budget movie. They brought it out to Hollywood, pitched it around. Nobody would touch it because it was so freaking crazy what he wanted to do. And he had never made an American film and he'd never made a film kind of at that budget level. But there are interesting things. For instance, the fact that he got Dan O'Bannon and H.R. Giger talking to each other, well, just a few years later, maybe a little movie you might have heard of, that Dan O'Bannon wrote, that H.R. Giger designed, Alien, comes out. And you kind of look at it and you go, oh, like Ridley Scott might not have really had the career he had Dan O'Bannon and H.R. Giger not been talking. And there's a bunch of connections like that that ripple through the film. And it's just fascinating. And, you know, I love anything that kind of chronicles, especially a crazy fucking creative process, but anything that kind of goes deep into a creative process. And this one, I feel like really... especially with us all thinking about Dune right now. And I feel like there's been a lot of retrospective talking about David Lynch's Dune. It's interesting to see the Dune that might have been 10 years before David Lynch's Dune.
Yeah, interesting. But I assume that because it never got made, this documentary chronicles the whole implosion of that.
A little bit, but it's weird because Jodorowsky is like not upset about it. Like... He seemed relatively unfazed, even though it seems like he spent a couple of years of his life. His son was going to play Paul Atreides, and his son had like spent 2 years learning the kind of combat that Paul Atreides would have to do. You know, I mean, I think ultimately between Jodorowsky's version, the David Lynch version, and the Denis Villeneuve version, the Denis Villeneuve one is probably the closest to the book. Jodorowsky, I think, was kind of using the book as a jumping off point. I feel like David Lynch was reasonably close to the book, but not close in extremely significant ways. And Villeneuve was not just close to the book's intention, but close to Frank Herbert's intentions that he went and fixed in Dune Messiah that weren't even in the book. But like, it is interesting to think about this crazy ass hippie, psychedelic acid trip of a movie that we almost would have had.
And 2 points for you for bringing Zardoz into this. So,
2 points. How many points till I get a free sub?
I think only three. So I think you're nearly there.
I'll work Zardoz in every week.
Get Sean Connery to, you know, that's a classic. It was always on the shelf at my video store.
You know what's great about Zardoz is, yeah, John Borman was trying to make Lord of the Rings, and when he couldn't make that, he was like, fuck it, I'm going to make Zardoz.
Yeah, it's good times.
Crazy movie. Highly recommend for anyone who likes their movies extra weird, who likes to watch a movie and then be like, was that just a weird dream I had, or is that an actual movie?
And if you want to get the flavor, the trailer for Zardoz is on YouTube from 1974, and it is psychedelic, to say the least.
All right. So, Ilya, what is your pet obsession this week?
I'm really excited. One of my favorite shows of the pandemic is back, or shortly going to be back, in May. I think early May.
I love it when pandemic things come back. Wait a minute. Yeah. That came out wrong.
Yeah, that's maybe not everything from the pandemic should come back. But one thing that absolutely should is Hacks. HBO Max series.
It's a great show.
Hacks season 3 is back. Gene Smart is back. And they have a teaser trailer that is now out everywhere. And so if you enjoyed Hacks as much as I did, that's going to be back. And it was
I don't know if I enjoyed it as much as you did, but I enjoyed it quite a lot.
It's funny. It's smart. It's irreverent. It's, you know, and I know you generally don't like to see shows sort of like about the industry. And that's not, it's not exactly the industry, but sort of steeped in the industry, whatever sort of world they create for the industry, I quite enjoy. And I love that sort of through the lens of like stand-up comedy in Vegas and all this other stuff. Yeah. It's like, it's
no, and, I like Hacks. I maybe have softened a little bit on my hatred of shows about the industry. The shows about the industry that always bugged me were things like Entourage. Where yeah. it's like kind of a fake-o, this isn't really what it's like version of the industry. And, you know, also like, hey, we couldn't think of a better story to tell than one about ourselves.
I got to say, though, there's a little bit of truth, though, in Entourage. There really is. It's a fractured version, but there's some truth there. You know, the world of...
I will never know.
As someone who worked as an assistant at a major agency, I can tell you there's some reality in there for sure. Yuck. Yeah. Anyway, but yes, Hacks coming back. Excited about that. I assume that we'll get the DP to come back again and talk about it, who was very kind and came to talk to us before. And so, yeah, I'm excited about that. All right. So, Ben, I think that just about does it this week. Where can people find you? They want to track you down.
You can find me at benrock.com. You can also find me at LinkedIn. A lot of people have been tracking me down on LinkedIn. I'm also still on all the social medias except for... TikTok, not on TikTok. And, you know, I'm probably going to wait to see if our country bans it before I even think about signing up on it. But I'm everywhere else. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
They can find me over at Hot Rod Cameras, hotrodcameras.com. That's a good way to track me down. Also, people have been reaching out to me on LinkedIn. Sorry, not LinkedIn. I say that every week. Instagram. I got contacted by someone from Instagram today.
I've had a few of those. Cool.
Yeah. Oh, and actually, I should give credit to Adam Bricker. Of course, Adam Bricker is the DP who shot Hacks. And so I'm assuming he's back for season 3. I don't know. I don't have that information. But definitely should give credit to him because it was great to talk about it. And I'd love to talk about the next season. Ben, we got to thank some people. Who do we need to thank this week?
As always, let's thank our kick-ass producer, Alana Cody. She's got us both working this week, doing some interviews. Just did one the other day myself. You've got a couple coming up. We got to thank Ben Katz, our kick-ass and awesome editor, who makes us both sound like not dopes, and hopefully pre-screens all the rambles that come out of our faces so that we don't bore the audience too terribly much. And lastly, but not least, we got to thank Kays Alatrakshi, Kays, who composed every bit of music that you hear on the show. You can find him at musicbykays.com. Hire him to score your next whatever the hell you're making.
And you know, actually, I gotta do a little thank you and a little bit of apology to Greg. And actually, now there are several people whose interviews we recorded some time ago, but because of the Academy Awards, because of so much stuff happening, a lot of those episodes that weren't as timely that could, or let's just say timeless, could get plugged in almost anytime, got shoved to a back burner. And Greg is the first one we're getting back onto the show. And if any of you out there are listening who are other people we've interviewed, you were going like, when is my interview going to run? Guess what? It's sooner now because we're getting some of that backlog.
Yeah, done. I think everybody understands that Oscar season, you know, kind of takes over the world.
It really does. At least certainly for us, we get so inundated by requests, and then plus we also have, you know, festivals and things going on South by in there. But really, in particular, Oscar season is the one that kind of
Well, and we're always trying to get all the Oscar nominees on, and this year we got 4 out of 5.
That's a record. It's more than the last 2 years where I think we had 3. We're
coming
for
all 5 next year.
That's right. 2024, we're going for all 5. So
let's do it.
We're doing it. All right, Ben, do you want to take us out this week?
Thanks for tuning in.
I thought it was going to be until next time.
Until next time.
Wow, you said that with such conviction.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.